The talk you're about to listen to is a presentation of Penn State Crew. To find out more about Penn State Crew, or to find more talks, music, and videos, check out PennStateCrew.org.
And so what we're going to do tonight is we're going to do a quick survey of creation. What we're going to do is we're going to look at the created world through the lenses of through three lenses, the telescope, the naked eye, and the microscope. And we're going to try to look and see about how great God is. In Psalm 19, it says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they display knowledge." There's no place, no language where his voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the end of the world. He's everywhere. His greatness is seen in every place. And it's not just the stars. It's not just space. It's not just astronomy that points to him, but all of creation declares how great he is. In Romans 1:20, it says, "Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made." So what we're going to do is we're going to kind of work through these three lenses, things we can see through a telescope, if we can see them at all, things we see just with our naked eye, and the things we see through a microscope. And we're just going to kind of survey through and see things that I think point to us to the greatness of God, to see how incredibly amazing he is. So, universe is a big place. We're going to start at home. We're going to kind of work our way out in concentric circles, all right? So we'll start at the Earth. Who knows how big is the Earth? What's the diameter of our planet? Anybody know? 6,006. Well, that's actually true. It's 6,600 something. That something could be a unit of your own making, but in, like, how about in miles? Anybody know how big the Earth is in miles diameter? It's about 8,000 miles in diameter, okay? About 24,000 miles in circumference, 8,000 miles in diameter. Now, how about the sun? Anybody know how big the sun is compared to the Earth? Anybody know? Big. It is. That's right. It's really big. Okay. Sun is bigger. It's a lot bigger. It's about 864,000 miles across, okay? Almost, so it's a little, if you like round numbers, just a little bit smaller than a million miles in diameter, okay? It's huge. It's absolutely massive, and it produces gargantuan quantities of energy. Now, some of you know, some of you that are physics and whatnot, but what the sun is doing constantly, it's being crushed, it's being consumed, and hydrogen is being fused into helium. And when it does, it's losing mass, it's losing matter. The matter is kind of being turned into heat and energy. And it happens at the rate of 4 million tons a second, okay? So every second, the sun is losing 4 million tons of its own matter. 4 million tons, 8 million tons, 12 million tons, 16 million tons. And it's going to keep on doing this for a long, 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 long time. In fact, there's so much mass to the thing. It's so friggin' huge that it can continue to consume itself at a rate of 4 million tons for the next 6 billion years, and at the end of that time, it will only have consumed 1/40,000th of its own matter, okay? It's huge. It's just absolutely massive, except that it's not really that big in astronomical terms. Our sun, our star, is relatively average, maybe a little bit on the smaller side. There are stars that are far, far bigger than the sun. Do you guys know the constellation Orion? Is that familiar to you? Could you find that if you went out and looked for it in the sky? I think it's maybe the easiest constellation to recognize. Looks like that. Is that familiar to you? Okay, so two of the brightest stars in the sky, bottom left or bottom right corner, that's Rigel. Top left is Betelgeuse. Betelgeuse is one of the brightest stars in the sky, A, because it's relatively close, and B, because it's gigantic. It's about, our sun, 464,000 miles in diameter. Betelgeuse is about 400 million miles in diameter. Okay, so here's a comparison. Here's the sun and Betelgeuse. One of the biggest problems in astronomy is that you just can't get your head around the figure. So we're going to do some things tonight to try to help you kind of try to stretch your mind to see just how massive the thing really is, because it's just absolutely kind of beyond reckoning. Let's come back to our solar system, okay? Now, how many of you have ever seen a model of the solar system? Okay? Great. Now, actually, you haven't, or I would almost guarantee you've never seen anything remotely approaching a scale model. Think back to your high school physics textbook or astronomy class. Probably on the inside flap, it probably had an illustration like this, right? So they always show the sun with kind of this curve to suggest it's so friggin' huge, there's not enough space on the page to take it. And then here's the planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, and on out to, you know, Pluto, which is marginal status these days, right? Here it is, okay? When you look at that, this is grotesquely, radically, horrendously deceiving. It's total BS. this picture is absolutely radically false. And the issue isn't that your textbook publishers are lying. It's not that they're deceptive. They simply don't have the space, not even close, not even at all, to make this thing be to scale, okay? Neither do we, but we're going to try. So here's what we're going to do. I need somebody to come up real quick and be the sun. Somebody, anybody. It's real easy. Come on up. Wait, okay, Andy. All right. Okay, you can stare at that. You can actually, yeah, come up so I can see you. That's perfect. Come up here. You're the sun, okay? Now, the sun is how big? How big is the sun? Huge. 864,000 miles. Perfect, if anybody happened to say that. 864. This ball is 8 inches in diameter. So this is the sun. Big yellow one is the sun. You got that? Okay. Now, the Earth, by scale, is this. You can't see it. Can you see that? That's a peppercorn. Okay? Right there. That's the Earth. Okay? The Earth's about 8,000 miles in diameter. So if this is 800,000 miles and it's an 8-inch ball, that means every inch of this sucker represents 100,000 miles. Our Earth's about 8,000 miles in diameter, so this peppercorn's the Earth. Now, the question is, if Andy's here, the sun, where do we put the Earth? That would kill us. Okay, that would be bad. Where is it? You want to guess? Okay, it's not here. Come here. I need somebody else. Nate, come up here, buddy. Take the Earth. Be careful. This is where we live. And I want you to go away. I'll tell you when to stop. Go. This is to scale, okay? When you get out there, Nate, when you a little bit past the rows, you'll see a little X on the floor. And, okay, hold that sucker up. Okay, if we were doing this to scale, this 8-inch ball represents our sun, and that peppercorn that you cannot see, that's where you live, right there. Now, bear in mind, this is three of the planets. Okay, so in between here is like, you know, Mercury, Venus, Earth, okay? That's three of the nine, and the space between the planets just gets bigger and bigger and bigger as the further you get out. There's a funny sort of kind of equation that represents how far apart they get, but they just get bigger and bigger and bigger. And so if we did three of our planets, we'd need about 77 feet at this scale to represent our solar system. If we wanted to go all nine, all the way up to Pluto, Pluto would be just the far side of the IST building. This is a scale model in which this little ball represents almost 1 million miles in diameter. This is why your textbook makers lie to you. Because if they wanted to put an accordion fold, if they just wanted to have like, you know, a flip-out thing, they would need 3,600 pages, okay, just for the stupid solar system, because it's so friggin' huge. Okay, so that's the solar system. That's one. That is one star's system. Takes up that much space. It's just, you can keep that. You can even eat that if you want. That's the Earth right there, okay? It is just absolutely huge. And there are probably between 2 and 3 billion stars in our galaxy, which is what? What's our galaxy? Do you know? The Milky Way. That's where you live, okay? So here's the Milky Way. Go back or pop up. So here's where we live, kind of on the left side as far as we can tell. And it's absolutely just gigantically huge. And there's stars, there's even ones that are bigger. But ours is big enough. In fact, think about this, okay? Go back to our sun. If we were to travel, if you could somehow survive, right? And you get to the edge of the sun, and you cruise down to the center of it in some, like, sunproof vehicle, and you go on the speed of sound, it would take you more than 3 weeks to get from the edge of the thing to the center of the thing, okay? Presuming that you don't get consumed, which you would, but in any case, or crushed, a gravitational smash, you'd turn into helium too, I suppose. It would take more than 3 weeks. And if you took that vehicle that's going the speed of sound, 768 miles an hour, I think, if you were to take that vehicle and cruise around the edge of our galaxy, to go around the edge of the Milky Way galaxy, and let's say you budget for yourself 65,000 years, okay? You travel on the speed of sound for 65,000 years to skirt around the perimeter of our galaxy. You may want to guess how far you'd get, what fraction of the circle you'd complete. 1 millionth. You'd make it 1 millionth of the way around the galaxy if you had 65,000 years and you were traveling the speed of sound. Okay? It is huge. And I mean, I'm going to give you all these different kind of ways to think about this, but the truth is, at some point, everything I say stops meaning anything, doesn't it? It's just too massively huge. And yet, somebody made it. Somebody brilliant and powerful and outside of all of it, made this thing that is just at a scale beyond reckoning. And there's things that are far bigger. There's a there's a cluster of galaxies called Abel 2029 that has a galaxy that's 60 times the size of our own. It's thought to have about 100 trillion stars. Just absolutely massive. And literally everywhere we look in space, if you get out the, you know, if you ever go online, go to the Hubble, I think it's called hubblesite.com. Look at the images of the Hubble Space Telescope. Here's one. Go another one here, bro, from Hubble. All these aren't stars. These are like galaxies, and just each of these represents billions of stars their own. And everywhere we point this thing, you just point it any place in the deepest, darkest, blackest space, and there are unimaginable glories, massive, huge, enormous energy everywhere we look, everywhere we go. Job commented on this fantasticness. He said, speaking of the one who created it all, he said, "His wisdom is profound, his power is vast. Who has resisted him and come out unscathed? He speaks to the sun, and it does not shine. He seals off the light of the stars. He alone stretches out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. He is the maker of the Bear and Orion, the Pleiades, and the constellations of the south. He performs wonders that cannot be fathomed and miracles that cannot be counted." And he does. He is greater than all of this, and there's nothing we can even do to understand it, never mind create such a thing. Let me give you something else. So think about this, stars in the universe. If I had a handful of sand right up here, I could pick up a bucket of sand, I'd have about 10,000 grains of sand in my hand. In the United States alone, there's about 84,000 miles of shoreline, and there are more stars in the universe than there are grains of sand on the Earth. It is just absolutely beyond reckoning. Okay? Now we're going to leave our solar system, leave our galaxy, go to another. I'll give you another model. If we did this, okay, some of you may have seen the Andromeda Galaxy. It's huge, and it's noteworthy because it's sort of semi on the fringe of being visible. And if you wanted to make a model of the galaxy, one thing you could do would be to get a can or a box of salt, okay? And you could let this salt represent stars in your galaxy. Each star, each piece of salt here represents a star that's on average about 1,000,000 miles in diameter. The problem is we're going to run out of salt long before we run out of stars. Because if I wanted to make an actual model of the Andromeda Galaxy, I would need 10,000 of these boxes to have every grain of salt represent one of the stars. Okay? Not only would we run out of salt, you know what else we'd run out of? Can you guess? We'd run out of space. Imagine for me, if I had my 10,000 boxes of salt, and I wanted to spread them out, and I'm making a scale model of the Andromeda Galaxy in which a grain of salt represents a star that's 1,000,000 miles in diameter. How much space would I need? Would this room be enough? Would the campus be enough? Would the state of Pennsylvania be enough? You know that it wouldn't. If you want to make a scale model of the Andromeda Galaxy in which grains of salt represent 1,000,000-mile stars, you would need as much space as is defined by the orbit of the moon around the Earth. Okay, so here's the Earth. Here's the moon spinning around it. This plane defined by that, that's how much space you would need to make a scale model. At which point, that model would be pretty worthless. I don't think anybody would be able to see it, right? The moon's about 240,000 miles from the Earth. Do your math, right? Pi r squared, and you figure out that it's really, really big, okay? It's a huge, massive thing. It's about 180 trillion square miles of space is what you would need in order to make a scale model of the Andromeda Galaxy. It's huge. It's massive. Who made it? Who did this? How could anything be like this? Isaiah 40 says, "To whom will you compare me? Who is my equal?" says the Holy One. "Lift your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls them each by name. Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. It is the God who made everything that loves you, that knows you. He is the one we worship. He is the one that we say is worth getting to know." And there's more, much more, much, much more, but we don't have time. So I'm going to move on, okay? So there's a snapshot just of a few things where we see his glory in creation through the lens of a telescope. Let's kind of bring it home, and let's look at the glory that we can see just through the human eye, okay? Things that we can see. We'll focus on the animal world. Anybody know how many living species there are of plants and animals in the world right now, as far as we can tell? We find them all the time. Anybody heard a figure? It's about 10 million, okay? About 10 million different species, enormous diversity. There are 59 species of eagles. There's 200 species of turtles. They range from about 6 ounces at the smallest mature turtle to about 1,000 pounds. Just turtles. There's this crazy, insane diversity. There's 600 species of eucalyptus trees in Australia, okay? Why? I don't know. But there are. God is inordinately creative and wasteful. See, he is incredibly wasteful. We care about waste because we need to be efficient when there's a scarcity of resources. God has never experienced a scarcity of anything. He can do whatever he wants. He's limitless. And so he made 600 eucalyptus trees. Mammals. Anybody know the smallest mammal in the world? It'd be shocking if you knew, because who really cares? But do you know? It's a hog-nosed bat. They look like this. That's the smallest mammal. Isn't that funny? It's so funny, because girls hate bats, but I knew you'd all go, oh, because they're small. But you'd hate that if that thing was in your hair. Okay? Those suckers, when they're mature, those things weigh, what do they weigh? They weigh less than 2 grams. 2 grams. There's 28 grams in an ounce. That thing's a 14th of an ounce. How about the biggest? What is the biggest mammal in the world? Whale, yeah. Yeah, a blue whale. A female blue whale. And they weigh 120 tons. So the range, we go from a 14th of an ounce to 120 tons. They're both alive. They're both creatures. They're even mammals, for crying out loud. Enormous, massive diversity and all kinds of things in between that are just completely ridiculous. We could spend forever on this topic. There's so many things. If you ever watched like Animal Planet, if you ever watched Planet Earth, all these things, it's just mind-blowing. But we're going to limit ourselves, for the most part, to birds. So think about the bird world. And maybe one of the craziest kind of birds is a hummingbird, right? You ever watch hummingbirds? I mean, they can hover. They can change directions. They do just what Kate's doing. Exactly right. Yep. In fact, I need somebody to come pretend to be a hummingbird. Anybody want to come up on stage real quick? I need to come on up. Okay, this is going to hurt, though. How do you get up? There's stairs, or you could fly. Okay. All right, here's what we're going to do. Now, I need a stopwatch here. What I want you to do, you're going to fake being a hummingbird. They move their wing in like a figure eight kind of deal, but you don't have to do that. That would be crazy hard, okay? But here's what I want you to do. I want you to beat your arms like this. Wham, wham, wham. I want 50 beats.
And how long?
As fast as you can do it. Now, here's the thing. You need to go fast because you're trying to hover. But seriously, if you do it too fast, you're going to like jack up your elbow and your mom's going to call me. So don't do that, okay? But fast, just below the threshold of pain, okay? And we're going to see how long it takes you to get us 50 hummingbird beats. Are you ready? All right. 50 beats. On your mark, get set, go.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
Go, 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 go. Stop. All right, good. All right, that was about 12, 13 seconds. Okay, well done. Okay, now, good job. But a hummingbird does that in a second, okay? So, I mean, you did well, right? So, you can go sit down. Okay, so 50 beats. Hummingbirds do that 50 times a second, 3,000 times a minute. How are your elbows? Your elbows okay? You're good? Okay. So they'll do that 50 times a second, okay? And you might think, well, okay, that's not really a fair comparison because they're designed for that. And that's my point. They're designed for that. They are designed to do things that are absolutely incredible, and they can just beat their wings 3,000 times a minute, and they don't do it for just a minute. They can do it and keep doing it and keep doing it and just dart around and drink the flour out of those things and do all their stuff. And it is just, if you've ever watched a hummingbird, they're just astonishing. It takes incredible camera work just to see it. Listen to this. This is a guy commenting on this. He says, if a 170-pound man expended energy as rapidly as this dainty animal does, while hovering, he would need 285 pounds of food a day and would shed 100 pounds of perspiration per hour, which is gross, just to keep his skin below the boiling point. Now, beyond the fact that that's really gross, the sweat part, that's incredible, isn't it? But they do it all the time without breaking a sweat because they're made to do it. They are designed for that exact task. That is really completely bizarre. There's 100 things in the bird world, incredible expenditures of energy, all because they're designed for it by some genius. Some migratory birds are ceaselessly airborne without food or rest for 3.5 days or longer. This said, this involves an awesome energetic feat, the equivalent of a man running 4-minute miles for 80 consecutive hours, which would be impressive. But again, they're designed for it. There's a bird called an Arctic tern. The thing flies about 20,000 miles a year. Again, the circumference of the Earth is about 24, 25,000 miles. These things will fly pretty much around the Earth every year. Black pole warblers, that's hard to say, warblers. These birds migrate every year from Nova Scotia to South America. It's about 2,400 miles, kind of the same distance from LA to New York. It's about the same span. And on that trip, it takes them 4 days, 4 nights. They never stop. They lose half their weight. And somebody did the math to calculate how the distance they travel and the fuel they consumed. And they calculated their fuel efficiency is about 720,000 miles to the gallon. Isn't that incredible? But again, they're designed for it. Thing is, and it's not just endurance. And so we could pick any category and find some crazy thing in the animal world that exemplifies things that are just astonishing. There's size, there's endurance, there's diversity, there's all these things. There's also capacities. There's also like abilities that we really are just barely beginning to understand in some cases. Did you know that sea turtles crush, right? Did you know that sea turtles can navigate, they do navigate by magnetic fields? They can sense the magnetic field around the Earth, and on the basis of it, they navigate. And check this out. It's not simply that they know which way is north, which would be impressive enough if they had some kind of built-in compass thing. They don't just sense which way is north, but they can apparently sense the strength of the magnetic field, and then they can detect, I don't know what this feels like, but they can detect the angle at which the magnetic field is intersecting the Earth, right? Have you ever seen this picture here? Not that one, this one. Have you ever seen like these things? This is like, you know, the Earth's a magnetic pole, and up at the top you see the lines coming around, and they. You ever seen this? This is kind of magnet superimposed over the Earth. What this has shown us is that at the North Pole and the South Poles, the magnetic field is hitting the Earth roughly perpendicular, and at the equator is basically parallel. Okay. Well, sea turtles apparently can feel this, and based on the directional stuff they get from the compass points, from the magnet, from the magnetic field, and the strength of the field, and the angle at which the field is intersecting with the Earth, they have a map of where they are in the ocean, in the middle of nowhere, because there's these signatures, right? So if the field is entering here at this kind of strength, well, that must mean we're Caribbean or wherever they are. And they can navigate simply by their experience, such as it is, of the Earth's magnetic fields. We know this because we can put them in an area and screw with them and like turn on electromagnetic fields and trick them. And we know that they respond when we start messing with the magnetic field that we surround them with. Isn't that incredible? So we could just walk through thing after thing after thing of these amazing things that somebody brilliant created and taught the sea turtles and the hummingbirds and everything else, and you and I. All right? He's a genius, and he shares his brilliance with his creatures. Okay, final category, last one, is we're going to look at things that we can see with a microscope. But for this one, we're just going to only look at one thing, really. We're just going to pick the simple cell, okay? The simple cell is very much alive, but by no means simple, not at all. Now, some of you, I'm sure, know this far, far better than I do, I'm sure. How many of you have taken, you know, biology, these kind of classes where you've learned all these kind of things about how crazy the cell is, okay? Now, help me out, because my training is not in this. I've read about it, but I don't know a whole lot about it. I know there's 100 trillion cells in a human body. They're incredibly complex, and there's remarkable analogies between a cell and a city, or between a cell and a factory. So shout out for me real loud so I can hear you, because it's hard to hear you guys. What are some of the things that we see in a cell that might have an analog in a city? What are some of those things? Okay, mitochondria. Daryl, what's a mitochondria in a cell parallel to in a city? Power plant, exactly. So mitochondria is going to produce the energy of this thing. So there's this entire power plant structure. Excellent. What else is in a cell? Nucleus. Okay, what's the nucleus like? The capital. That's right. It's the direction setting kind of makes everything happen. So you got the nucleus and mitochondria. What else do we have? Cytoplasm. Who said that? Okay, how does that relate to this, to a city? So it's basically a transportation system? Is that okay, excellent. See, this is what I'm saying. I don't know all of the names of all of these different parts. What else? What else do we have? Ribosome? Lysosome. Who's saying this? Yeah, that's like the recycling plant, basically, right? It takes stuff and it breaks it down. Garbage plant, recycling plant. Good. Membrane. Okay, what's a membrane like? Yeah, it's the wall, right? It's going to keep stuff out, right? But that wall has gates, millions of little gates, right? There's a whole regulated system. There's all this absolutely astonishing complexity that we can see in a simple cell. Listen to that. I want to read you something. This is a little bit lengthy. Listen to Michael Denton. Michael Denton's an author. This is really fascinating. He proposes what we do is we should take a cell and blow it up so it's a billion times its original size. Okay, a billion times its size. It would be about 12 miles in diameter, and then we can walk into it through one of these openings, one of these million gates around the wall. Here's what he says. He says, we would find ourselves in a world of supreme technology and bewildering complexity. We would see endless, highly organized corridors and conduits branching in every direction away from the perimeter of the cell, some leading to the central memory bank and the nucleus, others to the assembly plants and the processing units. Within the nucleus itself, we would see miles of coiled chains of the DNA molecules. We would see that nearly every feature of our own machines has its analog in the cell. So artificial languages and their decoding systems, memory banks for information storage and retrieval, elegant control systems regulating the automated assembly of parts and components, error, fail-safe, and proofreading devices for quality control, assembly processes involving the principles of prefabrication and modular construction. What we would be witnessing would be an object resembling an immense automated factory, a factory larger than a city and carrying out almost as many unique functions as all the manufacturing activities as man on Earth. However, it would be a factory which would have one capacity not equaled in any of our own most advanced machines, for it would be capable of replicating its entire structure within a matter of a few hours. To witness such an act at a magnification of 1,000 million times would be an awe-inspiring spectacle. Indeed, it would. You guys, we get pretty excited about iPad 3s, right? Well, if your iPad can ever split itself in half and grow another one, then come talk to me, all right? This is astonishing. Enormous order and function, capacity, complexity, design, beauty, and it can make another one of itself in a matter of a few hours. It is just absolutely beyond understanding how there could be something, the simple cells, terribly named, how there could be anything of that complexity, and there's 100 trillion of them in you. You are 100 trillion of them. Now we know, I think, in just our whole lives, we all know intuitively that every effect must have a cause. And every effect, not just a cause, but a sufficient cause. The cause has to be capable of producing the effect. And the complexity, order, magnitude, beauty, design, all of it, of everything in creation, through the telescope, through our naked eye, through a microscope, I think that it screams that there must be a God. These things didn't just happen. It doesn't just come into being. Somebody made it. Somebody brilliant had to make all this stuff, to think it up, to design it, to create matter out of nothing. Somebody made it. And while I don't think that we can know everything, not hardly, we can't know everything about the Creator on the basis of His creation, I think some things do come across. I think we can infer from what we see around us that He's brilliant, that He's powerful, maybe even that He's good. Now, I would be honest with you, there's evidence that would suggest in creation that He's not good. And that's another conversation for another day, because the creation is not as it was originally meant to be. Something has broken it. And I think we could mistakenly infer from the badness in the universe that was part of the original design. And I don't think it was. But again, that's another whole conversation. But when we look into the universe, look up close, look out deep, somebody had to make this thing, and He must be brilliant. He must be powerful. And there's a lot of evidence that would say that He's good. But we can't know everything about Him. When we look and we see those things, we can infer those things, but those are kind of sketchy, vague details. We can't know all there is to know simply by gazing into space, simply by looking through a microscope. C.S. Lewis said this. He said, if Hamlet and Shakespeare were ever to meet, it must be Shakespeare's doing. Think about that. Unpack that in your mind. If Hamlet and Shakespeare were ever to meet, it must be Shakespeare's doing. That's a profound thought. I think what he means is this. If Hamlet, who is a character in a play, could somehow become sentient, could somehow become conscious, self-aware, he could look around himself and he could see the order and the design and the universe that he inhabits, the story that is his frame of life, and he could infer that there must be an author to this story. But he could never look off the page. There would be no way that he could ever somehow get outside of his own context to look off the page into London and see Shakespeare writing a story. He could never do it. If Hamlet and Shakespeare were ever to meet, Shakespeare would have to be the initiator. Hamlet could never intuit what his author is like. But Shakespeare could, if he chose to, write himself as a character into the play. He could enter, Hamlet could, can't just climb into his world, but Shakespeare could enter his. He could write himself as a character into the play. And writing his own name in the story, he could show up and he could speak to Hamlet and he could tell him anything he wanted him to know. And he could reveal himself to us. And I believe that that's exactly what God has done. That he's created a world that is so astonishing in its vastness and power and beauty and in complexity and order and design that we have to say, okay, somebody made the thing. But that we wouldn't know who he was. We wouldn't be able to figure out all about him unless he entered the story. And he did that. I believe that God has entered into our story, that he wrote himself, as it were, as a character into this play. He became a man who was born a baby in a virgin's womb. And he lived on the earth, and he came and he spoke, and he revealed the things about God that we could never know apart from that kind of revelation. That's not the only time he's done that. He's entered the world and intervened in other people's lives, in Moses' life. He could speak into Moses, he could speak into Elijah, he could speak to David. But most poignantly, most powerfully, he entered the world in the form of his son and came and dwelt among us and pointed us to him. Now again, that what he did while he was here, that's its own whole astonishing story that we're not really going to break into so much tonight. All I want you to do is to consider, is God worth knowing? Is the God who made all of this incredible order, all of this design, all of this astonishing beauty, is he worth knowing? I believe that he is, and I believe that when he entered the earth in the body of Jesus, when he walked among us, he gave an indication not just that he is worth knowing, but that we are worth knowing to him. Here's what it says about Jesus. It says, he is the image of the invisible God. By him, all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. All things were created by him and for him, and in him all things hold together. Jesus Christ himself is the one who made the universe. And having made it, he came in to redeem it. Now again, why he did it and what he did when he got here, we'll talk about it at another time. But consider, is he worth getting to know? I believe that he is. And I believe that question is worth asking. It's an important question because he's not only our creator, but he is also our judge. He cares how we live our lives. He cares about how we relate to him. And if that sounds to you like that's frightening news, that God is not just creator, but he's also a judge, there's also good news because he's creator and judge, and he's also redeemer. It is kind of bad news that he is a judge. Bad news for us because we're bad and we do bad things. But because he is also a redeemer, he enters into the world to confront and to correct and to heal our badness and our brokenness, to take upon himself our sin and our shame. And all of this, again, I think it just adds to the case that he is worth getting to know. Not only did he create the world, not only does he judge the world, but he is redeeming the world. And we can know him. We can have a relationship with him. So tonight, and we'll talk more about this at another time, but tonight I want you to consider creation and ask yourself, would the God who made this be worth getting to know? And if you conclude that he is, then I'd invite you to stick around. This is what we talk about all the time because we really think that he is absolutely worth knowing. And we'd love to tell you what we've learned about him from what he's revealed about himself to us. I'll pray for you and we'll be done. Lord Jesus, you are great and you deserve all our praise. We should spend our lives worshiping you and honoring you and adoring you. And Lord, sometimes we do and often we don't. Lord, I pray for those that are here tonight that they might consider afresh your greatness. Lord, I pray that whatever problems they're facing that seem insurmountable perhaps might seem smaller against the backdrop of your enormous power. Those that perhaps haven't ever thought that you're nearly as interesting as the latest game on an Xbox might consider that you're actually far, far greater than that. Lord, I pray for those here that know that you are a judge but have no hope that you are a redeemer, that perhaps by your grace you would help them to see how sweet you are and your kindness toward them. Lord, we thank you that you love us, that you made this whole ridiculously enormous universe of power and beauty so that we could live in it. And you made it so that we could live in it so that we could ultimately live with you. We love you, Jesus.
The talk you have just listened to is a presentation of Penn State Crew. Crew is a community where the gospel captures hearts, transforms lives, and launches men and women into a lifelong adventure with Jesus Christ. To find out more about Penn State Crew, or to find more talks, music, and videos, check out PennStateCrew.org. That's PennStateCRU.org. This talk is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license. You are free to copy and distribute this talk to others as long as you do not do it for commercial purposes or alter, transform, or build upon this talk in any way.